given many talks to non-biologists. But so essentially, what you've heard so far is the critical fact that androgenesis is a very dynamic process. And so then there's a real need to take this process, to visualize this process in real time in a living embryo or organism. And so one can do this, of course, in culture, and you'll hear more about this. One can do it in a living organism. You'll hear from Charlie Little this afternoon about doing it in chick embryos. And the organism I'll be telling you about today is the zebrafish embryo. And the zebrafish embryo has been around, or the zebrafish model, if you wish, has been around for about 30 years now. So it's a relative newcomer in the terms of the an organism to study vertebrate-specific biology. And what you're looking at here is a 2-day-old, 48-hour-old zebrafish embryo. And this is a transgenic embryo which expresses this fluorescent protein called GFP under the control of the VEGF one of the VEGF receptors. So one of the main attractions of this system is the fact that fertilization is external, as I'll show you in a few minutes, but essentially then you can visualize blood flow in all the vessels from essentially the time the vasculature is functional. So let me show you, let me orient you a little here and come back to the embryo. So what we're looking at the previous movie was this part of the embryo. So of course, here's the head, here's the tail, there's a big mass of yolk right here. And essentially you have two main vessels that run along the embryo, an aorta and a vein. And then you have, at each somite boundary, you have intersomatic vessels. So let's come back maybe to this movie. So essentially then, in the aorta, the blood is flowing from the head area down to the trunk or down to the tail and then coming back through the vein. And then you can see blood flow through these intersomatic vessels that formed by androgenesis. And essentially, alternating, you have one connected to the aorta, so blood will flow this way, come down here, and then come back, and then down to the vein. So essentially, this is what was the main attraction of the system, the ability to visualize these dynamic processes like the vascular system as well as the heart. And just to show you, and I'll show you another movie of these stages, but essentially what you have is a big mass of yolk on top of which sits the cell, and then you have a series of rapid cleavages, and then by essentially 12 hours, you have most of the tissues are formed, and by 24 hours, most of the organs are formed, which is another advantage of the system, that is that development is very rapid. So it's about twice as fast as frog or chick. So it would take about 8.5 days for a mouse embryo to get to this stage, about 3 weeks for a human embryo to get to this stage. And this is now what Brent Weinstein, who's one of the leaders in the field using the zebrafish to study various aspects of endothelial cell biology, what it is to generate this picture, essentially inject into the heart a fluorescent dye. So this is angiography, if you wish, in the fish embryo, to highlight all the vessels. Okay, so what you're looking at here are the vessels that are open and allow this dye to go through. Much like the vasculature is visible and easily observable, so is the heart. So here's again the eye, and essentially the blood is flowing in this direction. At this stage, you already have two chambers formed in the heart. There's a collecting chamber called the atrium, and the pumping chamber called the ventricle, and we'll come back to this organ later on. But you can imagine, so one of the main approaches in fish is genetics. That is, you mutagenize the genome and then look for mutations that will perturb the formation of these organs, the heart or the vasculature. And this is one of the main topics I'll be addressing. So this is a way to identify critical regulators that essentially are involved in the formation of an organ like the heart or the differentiation of various cell types. Okay. So essentially what I'll do is spend a few more minutes telling you about the fish system, and then I'll tell you about two aspects of endothelial cell biology. One has to do with just the basic setup of the formation of the vasculature, starting with the differentiation of the cells, the assembly and formation of the main vessels. We'll also look at the very specific and very interesting aspects of endothelial morphogenesis. And that is, when you form the heart, essentially, initially, this organ forms or functions as a peristaltic pump. And then essentially, as the heart matures and the contractions get stronger, you have to form valves between the chambers to prevent retrograde blood flow. And the formation of these valves is by a specialized subset of endothelial cells. And I'll show you that very intricate process. And the reason I want to show you this is essentially to show you, to illustrate the fact that using this model system, we're able to look and visualize single cells. And so the goal, one of the goals of the field, is to be able to understand developmental processes at the single cell level. And then finally, and because imaging is such a powerful and an integral part of working with this system, with the zebrafish embryo, which is somewhat transparent, what we're using now in my lab, a physicist in the lab has come up with this new confocal microscope that's allowing us to essentially do real-time imaging. And so compared to the previous movie I showed you, the next movie I'll show you is again using this transgenic line, which is expressing this fluorescent protein in the endocardial layer of the heart. So as you know, essentially, so the heart at this stage is two chambers. The blood is flowing this direction. This is the atrium. This is the ventricle, so the collecting chamber, the pumping chamber, and there are two cell layers. There's the myocardial layer on the outside. That's the muscle layer. And then there's the endocardial layer, and endocardial refers to the endothelium in the heart. So what I'll be showing you is the endocardial layer, the inner layer, expressing this fluorescent protein in real time. So this is a confocal slice. And we'll come back to this movie later on. We can have the room a little darker. But essentially, a few things to note. One is that you have this bending of the endocardial cells within the heart as the heart contracts. And another point that I'll come back to later is really the occlusion of the lumen, the cardiac lumen, by these endocardial cells as the myocardium. So I told you I would show you a movie of zebrafish development. So essentially starting from, so again, this is the big mass of yolk, and you have two cells on top of this yolk. So this is now the two-cell stage, 40 minutes after fertilization. And the things to note is essentially that development is very rapid, as I mentioned. And unlike mouse embryos or even the early stages of chick embryos, what's unique about this system is the fact that you can visualize and thus perturb these early stages of development. So here, the series of rapid cleavages right here. So every 20 minutes, you have a cleavage. Then these cells essentially come and surround the yolk as a skeep cap would go over your head. Then you have the formation of the embryo. We have the somites, the eye, there's the tail bud right here.
How much time is that?
This was essentially 20 hours.
And how many cells are there about?
So by this stage, there are about 10,000 cells. So there's very little growth overall. It's all essentially like cleavage. And then we start getting proliferation and a growth at this stage. Okay. So, and as I mentioned, fertilization is external. So essentially the way you work with these organisms, and many of you may have had these fish at home, essentially, you put a male and a female together in the evening. You have to separate them from the eggs because they'll tend to eat their eggs. But essentially, then, as the lights come on, then the male will chase the female, and she will release her eggs. He will fertilize the eggs. And then 24 hours later, then you see these fully formed embryos, and the heart is already beating. Some music does affect negatively this process. So essentially, I showed you a movie through these stages right here. by 24 hours, then essentially many of the organ systems are set up. The heart, by 48 hours, you can clearly see the gut and other internal organs and so on. It takes about 3 months, so it's about the same time as the mouse to go from an embryo to a fertile adult. So we don't gain much time in that sense. And when you think about doing genetics, i.e. pathogenizing genomes and looking for rare events, of course, numbers is essential. And so the other advantage of these fish is that they generate lots of eggs. So we're talking about 500, up to 500 to 1,000 eggs per mating, pair mating. So if you're looking for rare events, only this is plenty of eggs. So essentially then, I've shown you the embryo, and it's very manipulable and accessible, and so people have used this embryo then very successfully for various types of experiments. For genetics, because these fish are about an inch long, in a room like this, you can keep hundreds of thousands of fish, and so again, genetics is about numbers, and so this is, as opposed to if you were to keep the same number of mice, you would need the whole building, essentially. Okay, so this is why people are able to do forward genetics. And then, as I mentioned, cell biology is really, in a way, one of the frontiers of the field, really trying to now merge these two fields, one coming from the single cell level, looking at what's happening inside the cell, with developmental biologists, which have been traditionally more involved with looking at tissues. And so we'd like to understand at the single cell level and cell shape rearrangement, cytoskeletal rearrangement, how these developmental processes are being driven. Any questions? So essentially, what I'll do now is move on to forward genetics, so the major approach that's been used in the field. And about 15 years ago now, two fairly large groups, one in Germany and one in Boston, essentially asked the question, can we find mutations that perturb the formation, the development of this embryo? And there were a number of reasons to think that that wouldn't be the case. One is the fact that our genomes, much like the zebrafish genome, is very redundant. So maybe, essentially, even if you're able to mutagenize single genes, you wouldn't see much of a phenotype because other genes would compensate. And I'll have a little more to say about that at the end of the talk. But essentially, what was found was a large number of mutations. So it was clearly a very successful screens, and not only were people just looking at, for example, are the eyes smaller or bigger, is the ear there or not there, and so on, but as you can imagine, then coming to the heart, one can also very easily screen for mutations that affect the formation of this organ. So for example, compared to the wild-type heart, this heart, essentially, you have the blood toggling back and forth between the two chambers, and that's because the valve that I mentioned earlier between the chambers does not form or is not functional. Okay, so essentially then you have no net forward blood flow. Okay, and this is of course one of the it's not only interesting developmentally but also medically it's one of the major problems.
This guy though doesn't last very long, right?
Okay, so that's another point I should have mentioned, and that these embryos are so small, they're about 1 millimeter long. So essentially, diffusion can take care of the oxygen needs of
mm-hmm.
these embryos for about a week. So essentially, then these embryos will survive even without functional blood flow for about a week. And so you then, what this allows you to do is, for example, if a gene is required multiple times during development, then you can look at the function of that gene
mm-hmm.
and repeat it times, which is, again, an advantage of the system compared to, for example, the mouse embryo, which would die pretty much within a few hours if it doesn't have a functional vascular system. So much like all developmental biologists, we're interested in a number of issues. One is, how do you form these different cell types? And the second question, how do you bring these cell types together to form the various organs? And then, of course, one is to think about organ function. And as I mentioned, the field has been mainly using this forward genetic approach. Jeff will tell you tomorrow about another approach, which is reverse genetics, so starting with non-gene and knocking down the function. And essentially, once you have then enough of these critical regulators of these genes identified, then you can start thinking about cell biological as well as biochemical mechanisms. So how does one do forward genetics? So essentially, in any vertebrate system, or any system if you wish, so you take males, adult males, you dip them in a solution of ENU to induce mutations, so this is a chemical mutagen, and then essentially what you have to do then is homozygous these mutations, because we are all diploid, so since the mutation was induced in only a single strand, then essentially you need two generations, two homozygous mutations. So essentially, at the end of the day, you create thousands of what is called F2 families, second generation families, cross these fish together, and then look at the F3 embryos. And just there's another cartoon. And so essentially, what was done is first a visual screen. So again, looking at the blood cells flowing through the embryo and the heart function. And then I mentioned we have a few now transgenic fish, where, for example, we highlight using dystrophin proteins either the muscle cells of the heart or the endothelial cells. And so we can then cross these putative mutants to these reporter lines and get a better sense of whether this is an interesting mutation. Okay. So let me just show you this one transgenic line that I showed you before. And this was done in collaboration with John and Chen here at UCLA. And essentially, prior to the generation of these transgenic lines, people, including companies, a company in Germany who did a large-scale screen looking for mutations that affect angiogenesis for obvious medical reasons. They wanted to identify other additional regulators of angiogenesis, and this company used a stain called alkaline phosphatase to highlight the blood vessels at various early embryonic stages. And so the point of this line is that to show you that, in fact, if you now look, and I think they have a higher magnification here, yeah. So compare, essentially you don't get much detail, much details in the head, but if you now look with the transgenic line, you can get much more detail. And I should mention that all these vessels in the head formed by angiogenesis. Okay. And of course, key to identify interesting genes is the ability to visualize and get fine details in the formation of these fine blood vessels, thin blood vessels. And this is the trunk region of the embryo, again, these various intersomatic vessels that I mentioned earlier.
We could have put the lights down if you wanted just to see them.
Okay.
Just one light.
Okay, I think that's a little better.
Yeah.
But yeah, so essentially, again, the point being that key to any screen is your ability to pick up subtle phenotypes.
So this is not normal angiogenesis.
No, sorry. So this is normal angiogenesis. I'll show you a few examples of abnormal, but this is still, we're still at the level of just understanding enough about the wild type process so that we can really pick up subtle phenotypes. Okay. The other point I wanted to mention is before angiogenesis is a process called vasculogenesis that you've probably heard about already. So essentially, the formation of the main vessels. So you have the migration of endothelial cells to the midline, and we'll come back to this process as well. And then out of this mass of endothelial cells, you have to form two vessels. So for example, here's the aorta, and here's the vein. I think we can have the lights back on, otherwise everyone will fall asleep in this warm room. So, thank you. So essentially, we and other people carried out these kinds of screens, and we and other people have identified many mutants, and essentially, and I'll come back to the challenges. It's one thing to identify a mutant, one can do interesting biology, but of course one has to identify the gene that's affected by the mutation. So what I'll do next is show you a number of different phenotypes, just to give you a sense of not only the interesting biological issues in vascular biology, but also a sense of the phenotypes that came out of the screen. So again, so here's the wild type pattern. And so we identified a number of mutations that affect the number of endothelial cells. So these are genes critical for the differentiation of these cells. And so of course, if one were able to block the function of these genes, for example, in specific tissues in humans, then of course this would be another way to treat pathological angiogenesis. As I mentioned, another critical process in endothelial cell biology is this initial formation of these vessels. And Luisa will talk more about this, but essentially, as I mentioned, you have these endothelial cells that migrate to the midline. where they form a mass of cells here. And then the question is, how do you form then these two tubes from a single mass of cells? And essentially, work in a number of systems has shown that cells, so from this mass of cells, a few cells will start expressing molecules that have essentially affinity for each other. So then these cells will then form an aggregate away from the non-expressing cells. And people are still trying to understand how these two different groups of cells start expressing different proteins with different affinities for each other, and then how you then segregate and eventually form these two masses. Another question then is how from a single mass of cells, or you know, let's say four or five cells, you form a lumen. And again, this is another Luisa and George will talk about this later.
What's the blue and red line?
Oh, sorry.
The colors.
So essentially, in red, what we're showing here are some junction molecules, just to show you essentially, because not only do you have to form a tube, but you have to form very tight junctions so that there's no leakage of the blood in these vessels. Okay. And then the blue is stain for actin, just to outline the cells.
Yeah, you may want to make sure people understand that they're looking at a cross section.
Yeah, sorry. So,
this is the whole embryo?
Yeah. This is the whole embryo, so in cross section. So, I showed you before, the head, eyes right here, okay, and the yolk. So, we're looking here at transverse, a cross section of these embryos.
And right at the zonal junction, then? Is that?
Right at the
junction between the zonules?
So essentially, these vessels that I'm showing you here run throughout the length of the embryo. So there's the aorta and the vein, and then at every stomach there's more. So to answer your question, what I'm showing you here is a stage prior to the formation of these vessels that go between the stomachs. Mm. So, and yeah, I should back up a little. So the formation of these two main vessels happens by vasculogenesis. And then once these vessels are set, then you have a process of angiogenesis, which is essentially the sprouting of vessels from existing vessels. So essentially what will happen is that a cell here will send out a sprout, a process, and then form these intermediate vessels. Yeah.
So are these individual cells really?
Right.
This is like five cells forming
from a lumen, from
yeah.
a tube. That's
oh,
correct.
Right.
Okay. And of course, in larger embryos, then you know, you need more cells. But you know, essentially, and George will probably talk about this. But you know, there are many types of lumens. You can form a lumen within a single cell. You can form a lumen with just two cells. So you know, and this is a fairly active area of investigation. So again, so this is the wild type pattern, and we found mutations where this process is perturbed. So again, the wild type, you have two vessels, the aorta and the vein. In some mutants, you fail to separate these two vessels, if you wish, so you form only a single vessel. In other mutants, you form three lumens, and then another one, essentially, you fail to inflate these vessels, these lumens. Just to show you one of these three vessels. So essentially what happens in this mutant, again, these are the transverse section that I showed you earlier. And what happens is that essentially you fail in the ventral vessel, so this is the vein now, essentially you fail to form a single lumen. So this cell appears to bisect the lumen. Let's see. So we're now moving from this issue of vasculogenesis to angiogenesis. And so, for example, here is another mutant, and probably the most visible phenotype is this one right here. So you have a set of vessels that essentially go around the yolk, right here on either side, and this process, this angiogenic process, fails to occur in these mutant embryos. Okay. There are much more subtle defects, and So for example, I mentioned the head region. It's a very complex vasculature, as you might imagine. And so for example, this is the mutant compared to the wild type, and here is an extra very thin vessel. So this one would probably be two cells forming a lumen, and this one, so there's some ectopic angiogenesis happening in the head of these mutant embryos. And again, so as I mentioned, and this might turn out to be a very interesting gene in terms of angiogenesis, and the reason that this phenotype is so subtle is because of the redundancy in the genome, and we'll come back to this.
Are these longitudinal, and that's a cross-section?
Sorry,
of one?
Yes, I should. So what we're looking at here is this lateral view. Okay, so here's the eye right here, and here's the head. And these are similar, just in high magnification. And what these are is looking down, so you would be looking down on the head of the embryo.
And these are vessels that are coming out at us, I suppose. The one that you were just pointing out.
Like this one here?
Right.
Yeah, so essentially this vessel runs, so this is the one right here.
Yeah.
So it runs essentially, you know, in parallel to the plane of the screen. Okay. Skip this line and just show you, I think it's a bit easier to see. So essentially what we're looking at here, here's the heart right here, these two chambers, and then of course out of the heart, you have two vessels, one on each side of the embryo, and then carried in the blood out of the heart. So these are these two vessels right here. And what happens in this mutant, let me show you, this is a confocal stack, and I'll just, this is a Z-section, a Z-series, and I'll show you through the Z-series. And in the mutant embryos, what you'll see is that there's a narrowing of the vessel on this side, and essentially this vessel becomes occluded and eventually regresses. So let me just show you the wild type first.
So these are cross sections, right?
So it's hard to. So essentially, what we're looking at here. Let me go back and. So what these are is we're visualizing from the top down, and we're scanning the embryo this way, okay? So this is what's called a dorsal view. So, but this, you know, it's because of the rearrangement of the embryo, but essentially, you know, the important point is that this is the heart, this is the ventricle of the heart, and then you have these two vessels coming out. So.
It's kind of like a chest x-ray from the front in a human, right?
Yeah. So let me show you this mutant view right here. Okay.
Each frame is a different level?
That's right. Each frame is a different Z plane.
So it's like MRI.
That's right.
Yeah.
So here is this thinning of this vessel right here. And then if essentially, you know, this is, if you look at a few hours later, because this vessel is not being used, and it will start regressing. And this is another area of intensive investigation, trying to understand how occluded vessels essentially start regressing.
So we're seeing blood in there, but it's still. Is that what?
Oh, sorry. So what this is again this line that expresses GFP under the control of the VEGF receptor.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if you were to do an angiography of these mutant embryos, you would see essentially flow through this branch, but not through this branch. So this is now back in the trunk. So again, still talking about angiogenesis and the formation of these intersomatic vessels. So here's the wild type process. And in the screens, people have found essentially these various categories of phenotypes. So sometimes you get ectopic formation of these intersomatic vessels, interruption, complete lack, or sometimes you get the formation of alternating intersomatic vessels. So every other one looks normal, every other one is missing. And then there's essentially what appears to be extra sprouting, if you wish. So excessive sprouting of endothelial cells from the main vessels. Okay.
That last one is intriguing. Does that mean that the capillary opening is, the vessel opening is wider at the bottom
this, yeah, I mean, you know, essentially, until you actually do angiography,
yeah.
Right, so what we're looking at here again is the endothelial cell population. We're not looking at the functional, you know, at the opening. Yeah. But, you know, this would, I mean, you would predict that, yes, you know, if there was a lumen forming in this mass of cells, it would be a larger lumen. The last one I'll show you in this set is essentially where one where the endothelial cells differentiate normally, but then they die. Okay. And again, therapeutically, if one were to understand how these cells die and able and one were able to regulate this process, then this would be, again, a very attractive model, if you wish, or avenue to target androgenesis in tumors. And so I'll show you some of the evidence that these cells die. So again, what these are transverse sections through this region of the embryo. And I'll rotate the stack so then you can essentially take a lateral view. And what you see, compared to the wild type, so these nice, healthy-looking cells, is that as these cells die, they show this characteristic, essentially you see, you know, small vesicles of remnants of these cells. Here's the lateral view of the wild type, and here's the lateral view of the mutant, where you can see you know, the cells dying, essentially they're starting to fall apart. So we have all these phenotypes, essentially, and the question, you know, how do you go from an interesting phenotype to the gene? And this is, of course, what occupies most of our time, and it's known as positional cloning. As you might imagine, these genomes are large, and trying to identify the gene is essentially like finding a needle in a haystack. And there are a number of tools that one can use, but at the end of the day, it still is very time-consuming. As you might also imagine, there's been quite a bit of work in vascular development, and so certainly not all the genes that we identify are novel. Certainly many of the genes we identify, for example, like the ones shown in black here, have been previously identified in other model systems using different approaches. Okay, but essentially, this is just the first part of the work. So the first part of the work is gene identification. And then as I mentioned, yes?
Yeah, are you finding any chemical principles behind that lead to these different defects? You're using different mutagens, and I'm just wondering whether there's any, you know, chemical effect. Or solubility, or what the mutagens might do. And
right.
Are you targeting? Are you able through this library now to start targeting specific genes?
Right. So that's a good question. So it turns out that most people actually use just this one chemical, ethyl nitrous or urea, ENU, and certainly it's not completely random in terms of the genes that are affected by mutagen, mm-hmm. or even that mutagen. Other people use mutagens like EMS, and certainly, you know, there is some bias. Every mutagen has a bias. Another way to mutagenize a genome is to use pieces of DNA that randomly integrate, and this is what's called insertional mutagenesis, and there's even more bias using that approach. But essentially, you know, we're not... It's not the case that, you know, every mutagen will create a certain set of phenotypes. Mm-hmm. Right? It really depends upon the gene that's mutated.
Mm-hmm. And any of the radiation, UV, or any
Right. That's another way to create mutations, you know, X-ray and gamma ray and so on. And usually what those mutagens do is create essentially large rearrangements or deletions and translocations and so on. And so for this kind of work, what you'd like to do is affect single genes. So often people stay away from
the genes. I guess I'm asking because if you find cancer in any of these, then you can start to relate those two.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah. So there are a number of people using the fish as a model to look at cancer formation. And certainly, you know, people have been doing screens. But as you might imagine, you know, there are very few cancers that will start forming in the embryo, and so what you have to do then is take these embryos to the adult stage and then wait for a year or a year and a half and to develop the tumors, and you know, it might take, you know, ten of these rooms to start doing this, you know, in a reasonable scale. But certainly, you know, yeah, no, that's another interesting point that we need to think about. So, what I'll do next is tell you about this issue of valve formation between the cardiac chambers, and really nothing else. I'll just show you just a few slides to highlight the point, and then we'll move on and talk about this new microscopy, as it might be also quite interesting to you. So, essentially, the point of the next few slides is, again, to bring us back to, well, this is nice, you identify some genes, but what does it really mean in terms of the biological process? Okay. So, what we'd like to do then, of course, is really understand at the cell biological level what's really going on. So, here is a picture of the heart, again, the atrium, the ventricle, the blood is flowing in this direction, these two cell layers, the muscle layer here in green, and the endothelial layer in blue, and it's called the endocardium. The endothelium in the heart is called the endocardium. And essentially, the challenge here is you have to create these valves at the various boundaries. So, for example, at the boundary between the atrium and the ventricle, or the boundary between the ventricle and the outflow tract. And what was first recognized using chick embryos was that these cells, these myocardial cells here at the AV, the atrioventricular boundary, are different in terms of the genes they express from the adjacent myocardial cells. And they're able to induce the cells, the endocardial cells at the AV boundary, to essentially undergo what's called an epithelial to mesenchymal transition. So you go from one cellular phenotype to another phenotype. And I'll show you some of this. And then you have formation of a cushion, and then this cushion gets remodeled to form essentially elastic tissue, the valve. Okay. So you have issues of patterning of the embryo. How do these cells become different from these cells? Similarly, and this is not just for the myocardial layer, but also for the endocardial layer. And then you have issues of essentially, once you have communication between these cells, these endocardial cells then change phenotype and form a cushion, and then there's a remodeling. Okay, so a very large number of interesting cell biological issues. And again, the way we screen is looking for mutants where the valve appeared to be defective, and this was indicated by the fact that there was toggling of the blood between the chambers. I mentioned we have in hand a number of transgenic lines that express green fluorescent proteins or fluorescent proteins in various cell types. For example, this is another one, and we're looking here again, these are the endocardial cells in the heart, this is the atrium, this is the ventricle. And you can see that at the AV boundary, so between the atrium and the ventricle, the boundary, these cells start expressing higher levels of this fluorescent protein. If you look at these cells at a higher magnification, what you see is that now these cells have acquired a different shape. So compared to the cells, this is a low magnification of this picture, compared to the cells in the atrium, which are essentially elongated cells, these cells at the boundary have now become cuboidal, okay? Which is part of the reason that they look like they're expressing higher levels of this fluorescent proteins. And essentially then, if you look at the various, the progression of this, so you have these elongated squamous cells in green. At the AV boundary, then these cells become more cuboidal. They also start expressing different proteins. So for example, here is this, we're now using the same color, but looking at different readouts. And you can see that these cells at the AV boundary start expressing this green protein on their surface, whereas the cells essentially in the atrium are not. And what happens then in a very stereotyped manner, so again, here is the ventricle, and here's the atrium right here. So we're looking at these cells that I showed you before were cuboidal. And now what happens is that the cells closest to the ventricle, these ones right here, essentially start sending protrusions towards the atrial side. And then, essentially, then these cells that have sent protrusions then end up in this middle region where they will form a cushion. And then the cushion remodels to form a valve, as shown here. This is now this so-called leaflet that's the precursor of the valve. So you can imagine this is a very complex process, and it's not surprising then that this is one of the most common congenital heart malformations in humans.
Almost 1% of live human beings that have heart defects are usually in this region.
And these tissues not only give rise to the valve, but also the septation, so the walls between your chambers, between the two atria or between the two ventricles.
Yeah, so of live births, of live births that have congenital heart malformations, the vast majority of them are in this axis that you is describing. And, you know, we can go on and on about medical terminology, but this is the axis where a lot of bad things happen in human babies.
Are you going to talk a little bit about what joint exists? Is there some more directed motility? Is there a gradient, a chemical gradient?
So this is, you know, part of the issues that we and other people are trying to find out. You know, what directs, you know, these cells, you know, to protrude in this direction.
Mm-hmm.
I've listed maybe 5 events, but clearly, you know, we're not even at a stage where we're phrasing all the right questions.
Mm-hmm.
So the transitions I've told you about are from squamous to cuboidal, so cell shape changes in the endocardial cells, the formation of these protrusions, and then essentially this epithelial to mesenchymal transition. And not only do we have genetic regulators of this process, but we also have epigenetic regulators. Okay. So if you block blood flow, or you block contractility of the heart, or you affect contractility through fairly subtle ways, essentially, this early transition from squamous endocardial cells to cuboidal endocardial cells fails to happen. Okay, so you have to think not only about, you know, the various mutations that might affect the developmental processes, but also mutations that might affect the function of the heart, or epigenetic factors that might affect the function of the heart. Hence, this is, you know, one of the main reasons this is such a sensitive process. And so just to show you some of the work, and I'll cut through this. So essentially, we're back to this figure now here, where we're using this line which expresses GFP in the endocardial cells, and you have this upregulation of the transgene at the boundary cells. If you take a mutant fish where the heart doesn't beat, and this mutant is called silent heart, essentially what you see is you fail to upregulate this transgene at the AV boundary. So these are the cells right here, and they fail to undergo this squamous to cuboidal transition. Okay. And so essentially then, this mutant heart, of course, has no beat, but also has no blood flow. So one of the main issues is, well, what's responsible for this failure of these cells to undergo this transition? Is it the fact that there's no blood flow? Because in fact, flow influences gene expression of these cells. But there's also the contractility issues, because as I showed you in this movie, and I'll show you again in a few minutes, as the myocardium contracts, the endocardial cells are also changing shape. Okay, so there are two influences on the endocardial cells. The influence from the flow of the blood from the inside of the lumen, and then there's influence by the myocardial cells, which lie on the outside.
Yeah, so this cell responds to the calcium, the human heart, or there are another mechanism which makes it like this valve working. This is like, I'm wondering if it's like a calcium gradient or just, I don't know.
Right, so the myocardium contracts after a calcium wave.
Mm-hmm.
The endocardial cells are passive contractors, so they themselves do not contract, but they're flexible enough so that, you know, essentially when the outer layer contracts, then you can see the deformation of the inner layer. And I'll show you in a movie in a few minutes. Let me skip this slide. So So essentially what I've shown you so far is that full genetics appears to be a fairly productive way to identify interesting genes. I won't have time to show you the fact that because you can put these embryos in, let's say, 96 well plates or 384 well plates, you can also do what is called, or what is referred to as chemical genetics, where you would use a library of small molecules, throw them on these embryos, and then essentially do the same as you did with forward genetics. Asking the question, can we find a small molecule, for example, that blocks this particular step of valve formation? Okay. You can also use chemical inhibitors of specific signaling pathways to block these signaling pathways at various stages during development. Okay. And this is, of course, very useful because you have the same signaling pathways used over and over again during development. So for example, let's say a specific PI3 kinase, for example. You know it's involved in multiple steps, but for example, you want to test, is this signaling pathway involved in a step that occurs at 56 hours, so valve formation, for example. So then you would put the inhibitor at that stage and ask the question, what is the phenotype that results from having this pathway blocked at that stage? And now I'll skip these slides and finish up with the imaging issue. So I think what's clear from this presentation so far is that imaging is key to our understanding of angiogenesis as it is to probably the majority of biological processes. But so what we need for better imaging are better transgenic lines, better tools, and specifically better microscopy, especially for looking at events like angiogenesis, like cardiac function, which happens very fast. Okay. And I'll skip this. Essentially, this is a way to label single cells. So for example, here are some beta cells in the pancreas. There'd be essentially 100 cells in this picture, in this frame. But only 3 of these cells were labeled. We do this by using certain genetic tricks that I don't have time to go through. So I'll finish up with the microscopy. Then essentially, this is the way we've been looking at the heart so far. Okay, just white light microscopy. And if you think about conventional confocal microscopy, essentially the scanning takes too long to be able to visualize in real time. And so what Jan Huysken, a physicist, what he did during his graduate work at the MBL is come up with this new microscopy, which is essentially what you do is use a thin sheet of light to illuminate the sample. And this is what the microscope looks like. So we have two lasers, we now have two cameras, but essentially, since time is running short, let me just show you the comparison with conventional microscopy. So this is conventional microscopy, confocal microscopy, where you illuminate the entire sample and then you detect in a single plane using this scanning function. What you do with the SPIM, selective plane illumination microscopy, is use a thin sheet of light, so 1 to 5 micron sheet of light, to illuminate that plane. And then you can then essentially image the entire sample, so you can use then fast cameras. And what this allows you to do, in addition to the real-time imaging, is you can also gain in terms of penetration, depth of penetration, and of course the image collection speed is much higher. So there are a few other interesting features, for example, less photo bleaching, and essentially what this allows you to do, what it's ideal for, are embryos such as zebrafish embryos, where essentially with this microscope you can go throughout the embryo. And so I'll just finish up then with a few movies. And this is the heart. So can we get this light up again? Thanks. So essentially what this was is planes were collected and then there was a reconstruction done. But essentially, so this was the Mdaka, another fish heart at 8 days. One can do then is, of course, quantitate. So for example, what Jan has been interested in doing is really understand at the various stages of the beating what the surface area of these cross-sectional areas are. coming back to the fish, the zebrafish embryo now, so this is now a transmitted light. So again, we're looking down, this is a ventral view of the embryo, you have the two eyes, and so here's the atrium and here's the ventricle. These movies are short because, as you might imagine, they occupy quite a bit of space. But this is now a double transgenic line where in red we have the blood cells, and in green we're lining up the endocardial cells. Again, this is the atrium and the ventricle, and this is the boundary between the atrium and the ventricle where the valves are going to form. And essentially, what you should appreciate is that essentially, even at this early stage, you see very little, if any, retrograde blood flow, so flow from the ventricle to the atrium. This is, again, now in black and white, the same endocardial cells. So again, here's the atrium, here's the ventricle, here's the AV boundary. And so what I was referring to earlier is the fact that you can see complete occlusion of the lumen of the atrium as the myocardial, as the muscle cells contract. And so then, of course, this is very then a very efficient way to create a pump. So, and I'll come back to this issue later on. But and then the other point I want to make, I think will be easier to see in the next movie, is the fact that if you take single endocardial cell, for example, right here, it starts elongated, and then as the ventricle contracts, then essentially it gets deformed and bends. And the other point to see is the this leaflet right here, which forms part of the cushion. This is the trunk vasculature, and I want to rotate that, but I'll just show this movie right here. This is now, we're going to focus on this cell right here. So what we're looking at here, again, is a lateral view. The head is here, the tail is here. And essentially, these are the main vessels, the aorta and the ventricle. By this stage, most of the intercostal vessels have started forming. But you'll see this one cell will start sending out protrusion. And this is a very low magnification. Brent Weinstein at the NIH has done much better movies at a higher magnification. And, but essentially, you get a sense of what's going on here. So let's focus on that cell. You can see these protrusions, and then eventually then it starts forming connection with this vessel running right here. This is the vasculature of the head. So we're looking down on the head. Here's one eye would be here, another eye would be here. And so you can see that even in this fairly simple embryo, you have quite a complex pattern of vascular pattern. And if you can turn the lights on, and I'll just summarize right here, and essentially I showed you that through forward genetics and also through chemical genetics, one can identify critical genes involved in vascular development. Suddenly the work only starts there, and to take it to the cell biological level, essentially one should use and utilize these various techniques such as the spin microscopy, really get a better sense of what's going on in real time. And so I'll thank you for your attention.
Any questions?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, coming back to these cells right here, right, these are the cells that are going to form the valves.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I don't know if you saw through the movie, but certainly, you know, if you're thinking about the blood cells and the flow of, you know, fluid through the heart, this region right here is a region of very high velocity, right? Very high. So, you know, clearly these cells are going to be subjected to different forces than these cells right here. And this could definitely be one of the regulators of this transformation of these cells to a different phenotype.
There was something several recent observations now
which
may create that. And the actin is the, because you know, we know neutrophils crawl or send out pseudopods. Is this kind of more of a little bit more melopodial kind of actin?
You know, at some point there's going to be, you know, protrusions from these cells, you know, down to these cells, whether, you know, this particular phenotype is due to, you know, shear forces or so on. It's hard to say.
But the actin seem to be in the periphery.
Yeah, I mean, you know, endothelial cells definitely, you know, yeah, it's where the actin would be. Yeah, sure.
Just a small comment. I mean, I think it's worthwhile, I guess it's the same with fish, that that's a fairly intricate extracellular matrix that they're entering into.
Mm-hmm.
That typically you won't see a lamellipodium when a cell is invading through a matrix. Typically it'll be a phyllopodium.
I thought that was a room as well as a gap.
Right here, no. What Charlie's referring to is, this is referred to as the cardiac jelly, which is a fairly complex ECM, extracellular matrix. So,
what's forming the valve?
Yeah, the cardiac jelly is throughout. But yeah, I mean, you know, whatever, it's some kind of protrusion. Right?
Oh, absolutely. No, I didn't want to. Yeah, it's a very robust protrusion. It just, I just wanted,
yeah,
just wanted to make get you the three dimensional picture.
Yeah.
So, a couple things. One of, it's sort of along the same lines, but there's the question of the aorta versus the vein in terms of how do they know topologically kind of what they should be. And have is there any evidence in your microscopy perfect to analyze it? Is it conceivable that there's some kind of little shear going on between the, say, the notochordal region, or at least some ventral tissue and some more dorsal tissue, and those shifts or something are talking to the cells, and it says that if you're closer to this position and you feel this strain, then maybe you could be one of these guys. Whereas if, has anyone even considered that? Or because you guys got the wide field there, you could probably do the mechanical kind of.
Right, now that's a very interesting question. So what Charlie's referring to is, you know, this is a cross section of the embryo. You have a central structure called a notochord, and so we have the mass of endothelial cells right here. And the question is how, from these mass of endothelial cells, we form these two different vessels. There is definitely movement of this notochord tissue in the AP direction, and so, you know, as you mentioned, it could be the mechanical forces from the notochord that tell these cells adjacent to them that they are different from the more ventral cells. There's only, I mean, I think, you know, these mechanical forces have not, I'm not sure you've talked more about them, but, you know, there's only, there have been some nice studies done in flies with, right, mechanical forces, but certainly it's one of these epigenetic factors that needs more attention.
One comment that I think, I guess I'm surprised the fish community doesn't emphasize or exploit more, is that what's beautiful about the fish from the person who works on birds is that you can kind of take the data to the bank on the fish in the following way. Fish are very precise structures, and they sort of, as DJ has pointed out, they continue behaving themselves even if they don't even have a heartbeat for a while. So when DDA or his colleagues show a malformation in a fish, you can kind of, it's beautiful because you don't have this huge worry like, I wonder if the so-and-so vessel is malformed, not because the vessel's misbehaving itself, but because the somites are, or because the notochord is getting fouled up. Whereas in some of the, certainly in some of the mouse systems, and I, you know, the chicken isn't a genetic system, a lot of times you see malformations of vessels reported in the literature, but because the embryo itself is in sort of terrible shape, you're always wondering if the primary lesion is the vesselness or the primary lesion is the overall shape of the critter upon which the vessel is trying to paint itself. Am I making myself, I'm a little convoluted there, but I think that's a real, real strength of the fish system.
And it lasts long enough for you to see it.
Exactly. I mean, the analogy would be if you're painting on a moving surface, and all of a sudden it's not moving right, then your picture is going to be a little bit wrong.
Can I ask one more question? We're here, and several of us here have this long program, and so we're trying to bring mathematics and biology together, and I think we can kind of do it through engineering. So one of the questions that I had yesterday that maybe you can answer, or other people can answer, is what are the physical forces involved in creating these lumina? Are they hydrostatic, osmotic? We don't want to just look at structure and analyze that in some statistical way. We'd also like to bring in the force part of the unit.
Sure, yeah. I mean,
what are the mechanisms and mechanics of forming this initial lumen from a single cell?
I think as far as the vascular lumens, I'm not sure somatic forces play much role, but I think George will be talking about this much more later this evening. Certainly, you know, we also work on the gut lumen. Certainly there, osmotic forces seem to play a major role. But again, it's about, you know, getting mutation in the right kind of channels, or, you know, the right kind of pumps that would affect osmotic pressure to really, you know, prove that point genetically.
If it was a pressure-driven thing, you'd expect to see more spherical structures if the pressure was enough and isotropic.
Right.
If you don't see spherical structures, then it's more likely to be within the material.
Although, I mean, you know, there's a major caveat that, you know, when you fix the embryo, you are going to affect the shape of these internal structures. So,
yeah.
You know, again, I think, you know, with this live microscopy, hopefully we can really see what the shape of this lumen is.
You have only shown longitudinal cross sections of the part. Do you have some transverse? I mean, those cushions, are those in a transverse cross section? Are they of a specific shape?
Right, yeah. So in the adult fish heart, essentially you have in your cross section, you have four cushions. So, like this. And different cushions, different valves, there's a tricuspid and so on. So essentially this would be the ultimate shape of these cushions. So, all around the curve.
Are they mainly composed out of matrix or mesenchymal cells?
It's mainly elastic tissue, but the other mistake. Charlie is more of an expert in this.
No, it's true. It's mostly elastic extracellular matrix with connective tissue cells embedded in them.
They could use that.
They produce that maybe.